Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. As you all know, there's only just another 2 and a bit weeks to the end of our retreat, the rainy season retreat. And so it's a time to, instead of winding down, to wind up. To wind up all of the faculties in order to get the last possible results which are in your power to achieve. As I remind you of a quote or a piece of advice which I've always found very useful. And I've mentioned it to you many times before. It was from the great German monk Venerable Jnana Wimala. But if at the end of the day that you put forth your maximum effort, that you've done your very best in the realm of your bhavana, your practice of body and mind, if you've done your very best, at the end of the day you can rest satisfied. You couldn't have done more. And with that attitude of trying to do your best every day, putting forth effort, putting forth all the skillful means at your disposal, not being heedless, then eventually you must reach one of the results of the path. There is no other way. But instead of thinking of results, one thinks of the causes. One builds up these causes, the foundations, for which results come in their natural course. And it's building up causes which is part of the focus of my talk this evening. Building up the causes for which enlightenment occurs. And those foundations, those causes for the arising of enlightenment, the Buddha called the 7 enlightenment factors, as causes but also as results. For when they are each perfected, then it brings about, or it manifests, that which we call the release, the freedom through wisdom of the enlightened mind. And these 7 enlightenment factors, which you all should know, just to run through them in brief: sati, which is mindfulness or recollection; Dhammavicchaya, investigation of Dhamma; Wirya, the effort, the energy; Piti, the interest, the joy, the happiness of the mind; Pasadi, the tranquility of body and mind; Samadhi, the concentration, the stillness, the freedom of mind; and Upekha, the equanimity towards all formations. These are the 7 enlightenment factors in brief. And just this afternoon, when I decided this will be the subject of my talk, I was just flipping through the Bhojanga Sanhita and some very interesting ways of describing these 7 enlightenment factors. And I want to begin with one particular way of describing the 7 enlightenment factors which is not made enough of, and it begins with sati, but describing sati in a way which I sometimes describe it, but which is not described enough, and that's sati in its mode as recollection of remembering, and especially remembering the Dhamma, the good Dhamma, the Dhamma of the Aryans. And in the particular sutta in the Sanyutta, the Bhojanga Sanyutta, which I was reading, it began with praising those monks who are purified in sila or morality or virtue, you are purified in samadhi, which means to achieve the jhanas. You are purified in wisdom. In other words, they've reached the enlightenment wisdom. They are purified in freedom, in vimutti, and purified in knowledge of that freedom. And those monks are worth going to, are worth listening to, are worth bearing what they teach in mind. Because as a result of listening to such monks, then one will go towards the quietness, the quiet places, both in body and mind. The mind will, as it were, separate itself from the worldly concerns to the inspiration for those teachings. And when the mind and the body are in seclusion, then it will reflect on those teachings through the memory of those teachings. And in such way, the sati bhojanga is developed. And it's an interesting that in that particular explanation, the sati bhojanga was remembering the good dhamma, but not the dhamma from other teachers, because the dhamma from elsewhere would not be sufficient to become an enlightenment factor, something which will be a seed which will eventually grow when cultivated to the full enlightenment wisdom of release. And to make that point, when the Buddha talked about the enlightenment factors, he always described each one of them as supported by seclusion or aloofness, viveka nisitang. And you may all remember that word viveka, aloofness or seclusion, to be referring to the very least the first jhana, if not the other jhanas. You remember the definition of a jhana, viveka kamehi, viveka akusalehi tamehi. This is viveka, this is the jitta viveka, the mind which is aloof, the mind which is separated. And what's it aloof and separated from? It's aloof and separated from the world which most people inhabit, the world of our concerns, the outside world, the business world, rather than the world inside the mind, the peaceful, beautiful states, when the mind lets go of its external concerns. So these things are based or supported by viveka. They're supported by viraga, which is either dispassion or like the fading away of things. It's supported by nirodha, supported by the cessation of things. So each one of these enlightenment factors is like supported and like almost like leaning towards things ending, giving up, not gaining, but abandoning, lessening, giving away. And they say lastly that I think the Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, that they ripen in relinquishment, in wasagga, and they ripen in these things. So they're based on giving up, letting go, seclusion, being aloof, being apart, separated from the world and all of its delights and attachments. They also ripen in the full letting go, in the full relinquishment, the full abandoning. And when we sometimes talk about relinquishing and abandoning, very often people don't know what they should relinquish, what they should abandon. What you should relinquish and abandon is all dhammas. As the Buddha said on many occasions, all dhammas are not fit to be clung to. And that includes the five khandhas. It includes your mind. It includes your ideas. It includes the way you look at things. It includes all of that which you call wisdom at the moment. Nothing is worth clinging to. So when you talk about it's ripening relinquishment, it's relinquishing everything. Everything which you can perceive or conceive of. Let the whole thing go. That's all the world of sankhara, sankata dhamma, conditioned things. So when we're talking about relinquishment, we have to relinquish everything. When a person is asked to relinquish, even if they're asked to relinquish something to give a donation to a charitable cause, they only give some of what they have, and they always keep something back. They keep something back for the rainy day, they keep something back to pay their bills, they keep something back for some reason or another. But when we come to the practice of Dhamma, when we talk about relinquishing some of the things in the mind, our attachment, we cannot keep anything back. We have to relinquish everything. Our last possession we have to give up, because with giving up our last possession we also give up ourselves. The self is measured by its possessions, it's described by them. The Buddha said, if there is a self, there is things which belong to a self. If there's things which belong to a self, then there's a self. If there's no things which belong to a self, then there cannot be a self. Give up all those possessions which you cherish. The very last one. Everything. Five khandhas, happiness, suffering, your ideas, your views, your plans, your future, your past, your body, and your mind. Let go of that which you think is your mind as well. Relinquish all these things. If you wish to understand the full meaning of things like viraga and nirodha, cessation. When there's a holding back, then there's no release. There's no freedom. There's no realization of enlightenment. That's the reason why people don't realize enlightenment, because they always hold something back. There's still something which we attach to, which we won't give up. Even though it's hurting us, even though it's binding us, we will not give it up. So how is it given up in this particular sutta? Just by going to listen to the Aryans, especially those who are arahats, fully enlightened beings, and reflecting on their teachings, remembering them. If you haven't heard those teachings, there's no way you can remember them. Or if you've heard them but paid no attention, or if you've heard and paid attention but refuted them in your own mind, saying this cannot be so, this cannot be true, then again you haven't even got the basis of the Satipatthana, which is the having heard those teachings. And the Satipatthana here is where you recollect those teachings when the mind is quiet, when it's, as it were, away from business, away from the world, secluded, I think they call it in the text. And when the mind is secluded, the body is secluded, it can remember those good teachings, the teaching of the Aryas, the Arahats. And as you remember those teachings, then you will investigate those teachings. These are teachings of the Aryas. You may not accept those teachings, you may not fully have penetrated those teachings, but there should be enough confidence and faith, some like spark of trust, to know that these are worthy of remembering and they're worthy of consideration. When we talk about Dhamma Vicaya, the investigations of the Dhamma, if it's investigation of that which isn't Dhamma, then it will not lead to enlightenment, it will not lead to insight, it will not lead to peaceful states of mind. And remember that beautiful definition of the Dhamma which I've given on several occasions here. And what is the Dhamma? The Dhamma is that which leads to Nibbida, to this revulsion to the things of the world. It leads to viraga, to nirodha, to cessation. It leads to upasama, to peaceful, quiet, settled states. It leads, if you like, to jhanas. That's what upasama is. Samatha and upasama are synonyms, as is shown in the Vinaya, the seventh adhikarana samatha, or upasama. It leads to avinya, the deeper knowledges. It leads to nirvana and nirvana, to sambodhi. Sambodhi, the enlightenment wisdom, and to nirvana, the cessation of everything, the final quietening down of this process. That's what the Dhamma is. So if it's Dhamma Vicaya, it has to be investigation of things which lead to that. And just to emphasize that again, the Buddha said that the Dhamma Vicaya is that which is supported by Viveka, supported by Viraga, supported by Nirodha, supported by these three things, the aloofness of body and mind, the fading away and cessation of things. This is what it's supported by, the Dhamma Vicaya. So be supported by these things and leading to that abandoning, to Vasagga. If one is truly investigating the Dhamma, one is investigating those things which lead to cessation, and they do indeed lead that way. So if it's the Dhamma of things like anicca, dukkha, anatta, no, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness and non-self. If you are doing those investigations well enough, it should lead to these states of lessening one's possessions, both physical and mental. That one's inclination should be to get rid of things, to burn things, to throw things away, to lessen rather than to gain and attain and amass and hoard, whether it's physical or mental things. And that's why, that I was just talking to one of the Anagarikas yesterday, we call like jhana, from the word jayati, which means even to burn away defilements, to lessen them, to abandon them. This is what the meditation is all about. Even Ajahn Chah said this very beautifully. He said, we practice to let go, to give up, not to amass, not to attain and gain and keep. So it's the Dhamma Vicaya of anicca, dukkha, anatta, especially, not just investigating five khandhas or six sense bases just by themselves, but investigating in such a way that one sees that this is just a sense of sight, this is just a sense of sound, no more than that. This is just one of the other senses. This is just the body, not me, not mine, not a self. This is just Vedana, just the feeling which comes up with the senses, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. It does not belong to me, it does not concern me, this goes according to the nature of things. Many years ago I went to stay with one of the Kuba Ajahn, the great monks of the forest tradition, called Ajahn Ben. And this was 17 years ago, and I remember the talk which he gave, the beginning of the talk especially, because he was about to open his mouth to begin the talk when a bird called late in the evening, and that prompted him to say that this is the nature of the bird to call in the evenings. That's all it is, just nature. In the same way it's the khandhas, this is just their nature to arise and pass away. It's the nature of body to be like this. It's not yours. It's the nature of feeling, of Vedana, to arise and pass away, sometimes pleasant, sometimes painful, sometimes in between. And it's beyond a controller. So if we could only just realize that, we'd let go of this striving to always gain pleasant feelings and avoid unpleasant feelings. We'll accept the nature of Vedana, the feelings, as Ajahn Ben was saying, we should accept the nature of the birds in the forest. He didn't get a gun out and go and shoot that bird for interrupting his talk. But that's sometimes what we'd like to do with Vedana, which we don't like. And we notice that Sanya perception, or Sankaras especially, that these two are just as they are, they're anicca, impermanent, not just impermanent. That word anicca is an opposite, not nicca. Nicca is a word which, you know, sometimes you see in the Vinaya. Sometimes if you want to learn some of the deeper meanings of these terms, see how they're used in everyday life, which you can find out if you investigate and study like the Vinaya Pitaka. They got a certain type of meal called nichabhata, a regular meal. In other words, if someone comes, say Sally comes every Tuesday to offer food to the monks, that's called nichabhata, the regular meal. They come every week or every 5 days or every 2 weeks, whatever. If it's regular, it's called nichabhata. Bhata means meal. Nicha, the opposite of regular, irregular, uncertain, not sure. This is another meaning of anicca which we should always keep in mind. Not just impermanent, but uncertain, unsure. Your perceptions are unsure, uncertain. You cannot rely upon them. Don't take them for real. If you take your perceptions for real, you'll be falling into the trap of Mara. If you take your thoughts as sankharas for real, all of your thoughts, don't keep some back which you think are the pure wise sankharas. All of the thoughts cannot rely on anything. Whatever wisdom you think you have is usually a rule of thumb, delusion. Abandon it all. Then Ajahn Mahabhua used to say that the sanya and sankaras, the perception and mental formations, are the playground of the defilements. This is where that they hang out. This is where they have their influence and they delude us. Vijnana, the consciousness, the last of the five khandhas. There's the quote from the Sanyutta. The Buddha said that any type of vijnana, it's not permanent. There's no type of vijnana anywhere which is permanent, eternal, unchanging. Said the pundits, the wise people in the world say this, and so do I. All vijnana, any type of vijnana, whatever shape, form, past, future, subtle or gross, all of it is uncertain, impermanent, changing. The whole works, you say, not that there's some vijnana somewhere else, some very refined which ordinary people can't see, which is like permanent and stable, and that's your real self. The Dhamma Vicca, this is what the Buddha taught. This is what the Aryas teach. And so one should reflect upon this, remember it and reflect upon it. It becomes Dhamma Vicca. And because it's Dhamma Vicca, what does it lead to? It leads to energy. Energy to fully realize these teachings. Because the Aryas, the Buddha said that there is something you have to do in this life. There's the meaning of life in the sense that it is your duty, your job, your purpose, which is to release the mind, the process, from defilements. To gain that liberation, the ultimate happiness, the ultimate peace, and nibbana, parinibbana. And to do that you need energy. It is a path for those who are willing to strive, to put forth effort, to get up early in the morning, and to practice and do battle with the defilements, to use all one's resources, not just willpower, but wisdom power. So use the advice of the Aryas, to use all of the skillful means which they've left for us as our inheritance, and to do battle skillfully. And if we do battle skillfully with energy, then we will start to get things like piti coming up. As we start to win that battle, as we start to see the Dhamma and start to eradicate obstacles and defilements, it starts to give us this joyful interest, this happiness of the mind, which as it gets further into the Dhamma, once things start to happen, this path becomes very interesting, very profound, very powerful, very full of bliss and joy. It's the nature of this path to be this way. The reason is because what you are abandoning in essence is dukkha. You're abandoning obstacles and burdens which one has been carrying around for so long. And once the burden has been abandoned, even the small burdens, life feels lighter, problems are less, there's greater happiness in the mind, greater joy. The energy and the joy usually go together. The piti and virya. Sometimes I teach that piti comes first and then virya comes afterwards. In other words, the joy in the mind comes up and that generates energy. You're really into this, you really want to do it. Sometimes it's the other way around, you generate energy and then you have piti. Now how often is it you have a good cup of tea or a good cup of coffee and then you've got some joy and interest in the practice? But sometimes you can generate energy in many other ways. But it needs that energy. Energy is something you can develop almost at any time. You know that if you see a snake, if there's a bushfire coming, no matter how dull you felt before, you feel alive when it's an emergency. And because of that, you know that there's energy in the body, it just needs to be turned on. And it's part of the practice of a monk to learn how to generate energy at will. And it's part of the four right efforts to be able to initiate energy, to be able to strive. And you get to know the more times you generate energy, the easier it is to generate. The more times you slacken off and become heedless, the easier it is to become heedless. You just slip down and down and down and down, getting up later and later, going to bed earlier and earlier, getting sleepier and sleepier. Do you wish to live monastic life that way? Sometimes we think we've not got enough time to meditate. There's not enough hours in the day. We'll get up an hour earlier. In Thailand we used to get up at 3 o'clock, sometimes 2 o'clock. Sometimes you didn't even go to bed or sleep. There was one great monk who used to walk meditation most of the night when he got tired. Instead of going into a hut, he used to sleep on the meditation path, just where he was. When he got up, he didn't need to go anywhere. He was right in the meditation path, so he just got up and walked. That monk became an arahat. You can understand why. He's that energy. The monks which I've seen, who have got great reputation in Thailand, all monks have got stirred up energy. You can see that in the way they do things. They're not slack. They don't mess around. This is like the stirring up of energy and the arising of piti. It's more fun in life to be energetic. With sloth, you get into depressions. With a lack of energy, you get into this very painful mind state. And you can't do anything, you feel bad about everything. And if you're living in a mist and drizzle, but instead of living in drizzle, you can live in the sunshine. There's like bright energy and piti. These are enlightenment factors. Both they're foundations and causes for these things to happen, and the results of these things as well. So you should always check, how am I generating energy? why am I becoming duller and duller? I mention this at this time because when the meditation retreat, the range retreat starts, we're all full of energy. At last the range retreat, and you have all the plans and goals you wish to achieve. If you haven't achieved them yet, you've got 2 weeks. Achieve them or bust. Go for it. Because you're generating that energy and you're generating that joy of the goal. The goal is there before you. You can read it in the books. Hopefully you can hear some of the taste of it in the talks. Certainly you should have a whiff of it by now, an understanding of what this goal, even if that understanding is not very clear yet, at least an appreciation of its value. This is an amazing thing which you're on the track of. Don't let it go. Give everything you've got. And even if you don't reach the goal, you'd at least reach the goal of developing energy. You've got an enlightenment factor under your belt. And pity will come with that. The joy and the energy. And the pity which you get is called niramisa pity. It's a very difficult word to describe, to define as niramisa. It's unworldly or otherworldly. Sometimes they call it niramisa sukha, because when there's pity, there will come sukha. These two are a pair, except in the higher jhanas. With pity, there will be sukha, hand in hand, like inseparable twins. The pity sukha of the mind and of the body. This is becoming enlightenment factors. And sukha you might call like the ease, not the happiness of like the world, of like winning the lotto or going to a good movie or having a good meal or sharing a good joke. This is another type of pity, another type of sukha. It can be appreciated in like deep meditation. It's a pity sukha of having released the mind. And with the release, there's this beautiful peace, the sense of ease, like a sickness being relieved, a burden being taken off you, like a person being in prison and released, free to go wherever you will, not in the power or under the control of defilements or illusions. A beautiful peace of freedom. And this is what happens when either you have insight or when you've got sort of a deep meditation peace. And both of them are two sides of the same coin. Insight leads to peace. Peace leads to insight. And when these things come up, you have the pity and the sukha. Sometimes in some descriptions they put this term pasadi in between. The pasadi, the tranquility of body and mind. And you know the tranquility of the body occurs when the five senses start to settle down. The lack of tranquility of the body is caused by the burning of the five senses. Seeking sight, seeking sounds, or getting rid of unpleasant ones. Seeking comfort, seeking taste, smells. Whenever the body wishes to have a delicious meal, you can see the people shake, as it were. You can watch people as they line up for their meal at the monastery, especially the people at the end of the line, because the people at the beginning take all the food which you want, and there's hardly anything left for you. And you can see that the shaking of the body, the tenseness there, the lack of tranquility, if that's a defilement which is bothering you. It's actually, if we had seen the monks here who just stuffed their bowls full of food, it would be great compassion for the people at the end of the line to sort of be able to overcome that. That's what some of the monks did in Thailand. And going to some monasteries, and the senior monks would get a full bowl to the brim, and the monks at the end of the line would only get rice to eat. Very nice practice. if you're at the end of the line, that was. That was the best part of the line to be in such situations. You were practicing renunciation, relinquishment, because that's what these enlightenment factors are all about. Relinquishing, not gaining, letting go. Anyhow, the prasaddhi, the tranquility, at once that you let go of things, you let go of concerns for things, the body becomes very quiet. You can sit still. You can stand still. You can walk gracefully without too many jerking movements. The body is tranquilized, it's smooth, it's graceful. When it sits without hardly moving. Because the body has got into quietness. The feelings in the body have been abandoned. You may still have aches and pains, itches or whatever, but you're not concerned with them anymore. You've let them go, you've abandoned them, they're not your business. And that's why the body becomes tranquil. The body never becomes tranquil by finding the most comfortable position. Because if you go finding the most comfortable position, there's always one position more comfortable than the one you're in. It never finishes, it never ends. But if you give up that concern for the physical feelings of the body, then tranquility arises. It's one of the stages in meditation. And when you sit down and watch the breath, after a while, when the body becomes quiet, you know you can sit for a long period of time. You don't need to be concerned with the aches and pains, itches, or whatever in the body. So even now that this is hay fever season, and I'm one of the worst sufferers of hay fever in this monastery. And when I start to meditate, and I start to put attention on my nose, in the first 5 minutes I always sneeze. I get that sneeze out of the way and just carry on meditating, and then after a while your body becomes quiet. You don't sneeze anymore. And the tranquility of the body sort of overcomes even things like hay fever, only temporarily, but that's a great relief. You don't sneeze in samadhi. And that tranquility of the body is, again, conducive to tranquility of mind. And that tranquility of mind is also part of prasaddhi. The prasaddhi, the tranquility, enlightenment factor is both of body and mind, and it's based on this aloofness. In this particular case, it's the aloofness from the senses. Especially the five senses, separating yourself from them, as if the five senses are way over there. The further you can get away from those five senses, the more tranquility you will feel in the body. If you're close to them, caught up with them, concerned about them, interested in them, then you'll be a long way from tranquility. Fading away and cessation of those five senses that brings about tranquility of body. When the body is tranquil in meditation, this you hardly hear, you don't see, you don't feel the body. Those things have been a long way away. And many meditators actually have that experience, the way they perceive it, as if the senses are way over there in the back of the hall. Or even further, in the city of Perth, and they're sitting in this monastery. The mind has become separated from the body, in the sense that the mind is not receiving the input from the five senses. That's the marvelous tranquility of body. The tranquility of the mind is much harder, because even though the five senses have gone, the mind can throw up all sorts of wanderings and thoughts, and ideas and fancies and philosophies. It can keep on talking to itself for hours. That's where it's really nice. The Dhamma Vicaya tells you this is all uncertain. All of your greatest insights are uncertain. Throw them away in your meditation. If they're truly worthy of something, they'll come up again. But the old ones, discard. Do not carry them around like a burden on your back in your meditation. So you can truly enter your mind of these wandering thoughts just by remembering the teachings of the Buddha, of the Aryans. This is anicca, uncertain. all of your conclusions uncertain. Put a question mark on them, and you won't value them and keep them so firmly. You can let them go. You let them go, it's so free. And you won't have to argue with anyone then. You can just sit quietly with a smile on your face and a smile on your mind. When you get citta prasadi, it goes into different levels of great happiness of samadhi, because this is what happens with tranquility. It leads to samadhi, it's part of samadhi. In many cases they say that there is a sequence here, that from piti, from this joyful interest, comes prasadi, tranquility of body and mind, and from that develops the ease, the sukha. This is the sukha, the happiness, the pleasure, which is going to lead to jhanas, which is going to lead to release. It's a pleasure of tranquility. It's a pleasure of peace. It's a pleasure of emptiness. It's the bliss of nothingness, of the mind going down into just so silent, empty, black, no places, bliss. The less you have in your mind, the more bliss there is there. The less possessions you have in your jitta, the less things you keep on the shelves of your jitta, the more bliss there is there. So all the things you keep, you hang on to, are actually blocking out and taking up space where the bliss, which we call sukha, can come in. This is samadhi. I was checking in those books that samadhi, they say, is the samatha nimitta. This is the sign of settled mind. It's like a leaf moving on a tree when there's no wind, there's no leaf moving. It's so still, it almost disappears. And if you keep it still long enough, it does disappear. It's completely gone. Nothingness, emptiness. The more you let go, the more things cease. And you're getting an insight, an experiential insight in what nirvodha is. Cessation. Things cease one after the other in the practice of samatha and the practice of samadhi. You see things which you thought were always there suddenly disappear. And you realize that these were just conditioned things. If they were truly ultimate, real things, they would always last. But they go, they pop off, they disappear. Then when they disappear, it's even greater bliss. And you realize, why was I concerned about these things? Why didn't I let them cease? Why did I hang on to dukkha? All the time I was being deceived. Valuing candors, valuing thoughts, valuing perceptions, valuing controlling. And all the time I was just valuing dukkha. I should have let it go in the first place. This samadhi is, the deep and deeper samadhi is just the practice of letting go. It's based on viveka, on viraga nirodha, it's based on these things like cessation and aloofness, fading away. And it ripens in vasagga, in complete relinquishment of all the sankharas. That's why the Buddha gave a beautiful synonym for nibbana. There's many synonyms for nibbana, for enlightenment. And this is a sabbasankhara samatha. The samatharing of all sankharas, all conditioned things, all khandhas, all sense bases, all thoughts, ideas, views, perceptions or whatever, all consciousness quietened, faded away, ceased. And it leads the upekkha, the upekkha, which just sees that the vedana is just that much, just the nature of the mind when it's not ceased, when it's active, to have vedana, to have sensations, to have feelings. That's all it is. It's nature, the nature of the mind to be like this. You don't need to add anything onto it. It's also the nature of the mind when it sees itself in its true nature to turn itself off. It's just the nature of the process, the nature of arahat. And you can't change it, you can't stop it, you might argue with it, but the Dhamma is there whether you argue with it or not. It's the nature of things. You can shout at the bird to stop doing its song, but it just carries on. And the upekkha, which is the equanimity, which the mind is looking on the mind, knowing that this is its nature, knowing that there's no me, no mind, not a self. This is all uncertain. So it's not bothered with these things. It's tranquil. It's at peace. It has this beautiful equanimity which can look on the phenomena which arise and pass away. It's just that much. If the realization was right before you, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not a self, then there will be equanimity there. That realization leads to equanimity. It's not, as it were, your business, because there's not you in there to have any business. You've retired, you've given up your ownership of the shop we call this body and mind. People can come in and go out. You don't own the franchise anymore of the five khandhas. You leave them alone. You leave the senses alone. Equanimity. When each of these seven enlightenment factors is developed in this way, it leads to the full relinquishment of we call nirvana. And again, that's one way of describing the seven enlightenment factors. There's also, and what I should add this before I finish off the talk, the sati, the first factor, does also mean the mindfulness in its normal term of that which is like a doorkeeper to the mind, which can also know the content of consciousness clearly. And sometimes you can start the seven enlightenment factors as I just described, and starting from memory of the teachings of the Aryans, of memory of the true Dhamma, and taking it to equanimity, or taking it to samadhi, and then going back again, because as I've taught here before, from samma samadhi there is the arising of the powerful full mindfulness, which is the mindfulness free of the five hindrances. And as it were, that you can go up to that sixth factor, even the seventh factor as well, the equanimity based on samadhi, when the mind has emerged from jhana, when it's soft, malleable, pliable, workable, when it's still free of the hindrances, when the mindfulness is so sharp and so strong. And I keep inviting everyone to notice the mindfulness at the end of a jhana, and just how powerful and strong that mindfulness is, just how sustainable it is, just how it can penetrate to such a depth which usually mindfulness cannot penetrate to. It's the difference between living in a twilight where there's enough light just to find your way, and living under bright spotlights, so everything is illuminated. The finest detail of the trees, the grass, it just is so illuminated you can't miss a detail. This is the difference between the mindfulness which is purified, then the mindfulness of ordinary living, when the hindrances are still blocking off most of the light, when that mindfulness is very strong at the end of jhana, then dhammavicaya. Dhammavicaya in this sense will be the investigation of things like satipatthanas, the mindfulness focus on the four satipatthanas. Not so much a teaching of the Aryans as such, but that particular teaching of the Buddha, which is the Four Noble Truths, or the teaching of Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta on the five khandhas. And with that sort of mindfulness, there's energy as much as you could want. Piti is always there. And that mindfulness which is at the end of a jhana is just full of joy, full of happiness, full of energy. You just delight in investigating the Dhamma. You delight in the work of Satipatthana. There's no force needed. There's a mind just loves to investigate Dhamma in this. It investigates the source of things. And if it is true investigation, with that degree of mindfulness, energy and delight, there will be the tranquility. The body and mind will hold still as you investigate it. If the body and mind is wiggling, you cannot really keep it under the spotlight long enough. But with that degree of mindfulness, the body and mind is stable and still. And they allow you to investigate it. How often has it been that you've tried to investigate the body and, as it were, the body has moved like an eel wriggling, not really, not wishing to be caught. The defilements are like that eel wiggling and trying to escape, because they know that if your mindfulness and investigation catch it, the defilements are dead. They will wriggle and try and escape. There's the defilements in the body. The defilements in the mind will be even more hard to keep still. But with that degree of mindfulness, with that degree of energy and piti after a jhana, even the mind stays still long enough for you to understand it, for the mindfulness to penetrate its truth, its nature. You have the samadhi, the ability to sustain your attention on the object, and the equanimity which is just looking without pushing or pulling, which can look on that which is favourable to you or unfavourable to you, which agrees with your old opinions or which challenges them and completely destroys them. The equanimity of the scientist who doesn't go into the experiment wanting to prove his pet theory, but goes into the experiment just wanting to find the truth at all costs, even if it costs him his very soul or his idea of soul. And this is what we do, and it brings forth the enlightenment. The release, the freedom of the mind, the cessation of all substratums of existence, the end of bhava, the end of dukkha. That's why the Buddha praised these seven enlightenment factors and encouraged monks, lay people, whoever, to develop these seven enlightenment factors as much as possible, because they lead to enlightenment, the goal. That's all I have to say this evening on the seven enlightenment factors. Has anyone got any questions or comments on this evening's talk? Okay. Okay, if you find any of those enlightenment factors are weak, then please develop them stronger and stronger.
Thank you.